I'd follow her back to the room behind the throne. He did so, and as the skin flap dropped closed, he said,
"Huh, I never knew this place was here."
Sylvanas did not reply, instead simply extending her hand for the cane. With a little bow, he handed it to her. Her hand closed around it. Nothing. The decoration was garish, but Sylvanas could see now that it was a fine craftsmanship. She was rapidly tiring of the goblin's game. She frowned slightly and slipped one hand up the cane's shaft to the gem that was perched atop it. Her eyes flew wide, and she sucked in a soft gasp of astonishment. Once she had mourned the life denied to her. She had contented herself with the gifts of her undeath, her devastating banshee wail, the freedom from hunger and exhaustion, and the other shackles that tethered mortals. But this sensation dwarfed them both. She felt not merely strong, but mighty, as if her grip could crush a skull, as if a single stride could cover a league and more. Energy coiled inside each muscle, straining like a beast of pure precision and power against a leash. Thoughts raced through her brain, not simply her usual calculating, cunning, clever thoughts, but shining, frighteningly brilliant ones, innovative, creative. She was no longer a dark lady or even a queen. She was a goddess of destruction and creation, and she was stunned that she had never understood how deeply the two were intertwined. Armies, cities, entire cultures. She could raise them and fell them. Stormwind would be among the first, yielding its people to swell the numbers of her own. She could deal death on a scale that... Sylvanas released the orb as if it had burned her. "This will change everything." Her voice was shaking. She summoned her usual icy calm. "Why have you not used this air now?"
"It was gold when it was liquid, see? And it was amazing. Then it became solid and red, and it was pretty, but ordinary. I had always held out hope I'd find more of the stuff one day. And then, one day, boom! The top of the cane turned gold and amazing again. Who knew?"
Sylvanas needed to get back to the feast. The other leaders doubtless were talking already. She didn't intend to give them more fodder by lingering here.
"You see the possibilities,"
the goblin said as they re-entered the hold, as if he were talking about something mundane and pragmatic, not something that had shaken Sylvanas Windrunner to her very core, with a taste of power hitherto unimaginable.
"I do,"
she said, her voice under control again, though inside she still trembled.
"Once this feast is finished, you and I will talk at length. This will serve the Horde well.
Only the Horde.
The Alliance knows nothing of this." "Don't worry, War Chief," he said, his old glib self again. "I got people on it."
Chapter 4. Stormwind. Anduin summoned his counselors to join him in Stormwind Keep's map room. They inclined their heads as he entered. He had long ago bidden them not to bow. Greyman and Shaw were there, of course. So was Prophet Velen, the ancient Draenei who had tutored Anduin in the ways of the Light. Of all of them, it could be said that perhaps the Draenei Prophet had lost the most in this war. Gen had lost his son to violence in years past, and of course this war had claimed Varian Wrynn. But Velen had witnessed the death not only of his son, but of his entire world, quite literally. "And yet," Anduin mused as he regarded the lavender-skinned being, "though I can sense his sorrow, he remains the most serene of us all." Sky Admiral Catherine Rogers was also present. Anduin had similar sentiments toward her as he did toward Spymaster Shaw. Anduin respected both individuals, but his relationship with them wasn't comfortable. Rogers was too thirsty for Horde blood for his liking. He had forcefully rebuked both her and Greymane for taking a recent assignment much further than he had ordered. But the Alliance had needed Rogers' hawkishness in the war, and Matthias protected the innocent in his own way. "It has been a difficult day," Anduin said, "but it was more difficult for those we addressed. In the end, the war is over, The Legion is defeated, and we can bury the dead knowing that tomorrow will not contribute to the numbers of those slain in battle. And for this I am grateful. However, it does not mean that we can cease our efforts toward making this world better. Instead of slaying our enemies, we must heal and restore our people, and a world that is dreadfully wounded. And, Anduin added, we must protect and study a precious resource that has come to my attention just today. All of these things pose a fresh set of challenges. Anduin could sense the small golden blue stone in his pocket, nestled there quietly and benevolently. He knew very little about it yet, but one thing he did know, it was not evil, though he understood full well that it certainly could be turned to dark purposes. Even the Naru could. Anduin withdrew the handkerchief. This morning, Spymaster Shaw reported to me about what he has observed in Silithus. Not only are there great fissures that have erupted, spreading out from where the sword of Sargeras impaled the world, but those fissures have revealed a hitherto unknown substance. It's unique. It's easier to show you how rather than tell you. He handed the handkerchief to Velen, who reacted as Anduin had. The Draenei took in a startled breath. Almost before Anduin's eyes, years, decades of suffering seemed to be lifted. As profound as it had been to experience it himself, it was almost more moving for Anduin to witness the material's effect on another.
For a moment I thought it a piece of a Naru, Velen breathed. It is not, but the sensation is similar.
The Naru were benevolent beings made of holy energy. Nothing was closer to the light than they. When Anduin had studied under the Draenei at the Exodar, he had spent much time in the presence of the Naru, Oros. The beautiful, benevolent being had been another casualty of the war, and the memory of that time was now tinged with pain. Even so, Anduin recalled the emotions Oros had engendered, and he agreed with Velen's assessment.
Although, Velen added, there is the potential for great harm here, as well as great good.
Greymane took it next. He seemed stunned by what he experienced, almost confused by it, as if some deep, firmly held belief had been shattered. Then he frowned, the lines around his eyes deepening, and he thrust the honey-hued stone toward Shaw.
I admit,
he said in a rough voice, directing his words to both the king and the spymaster.
I thought perhaps you were exaggerating. You weren't. This stuff is powerful and dangerous.
Shaw waved the stone away. He seemed to have no desire to handle it more than was necessary. Anduin respected that. Rogers took it next. She stumbled, reaching out to grasp the side of the large map table for balance, gazing raptly at the tiny piece of stone. Then her expression turned to one of anger and hope commingled. Is there more of this? Shaw gave Velen and Rogers an edited version of what he had told Gen and Anduin earlier. The two listened intently. When he had finished, Rogers said, If we can find a way to use this, we could crush the Horde.
The thought of Sylvanas with this sickens me,
Gen said, not mincing words. Why must we bend everything to violence? Anduin thought with his own hint of anger. Instead, he said, answering Roger's first question, I told Spymaster Shaw we must obtain more of this and study it. I believe there are far better things we can do with the substance than create methods to kill more efficiently.
Sylvanas wouldn't think so, and neither must we.
Anduin leveled his blue-eyed gaze at Greymane. I would say that what makes us better than her is that we do think so. As Gen started to protest, Anduin lifted a hand. But I would never leave the Alliance vulnerable. With enough information, we can apply our skills to more than one task. He squared his shoulders and turned his attention to the map of Azeroth spread before him, his blue eyes roaming the image of a world that had become newly precious to him. His gaze lingered on the home of Stormwind's nearest ally, the Dwarven Lands, and their capital city of Ironforge. Humans did not stand alone against the Legion, Anduin reminded those assembled. We were joined in that fight by the Draenei and those Pandaren who had chosen the Alliance. Your people too, Gen. Worgen and human refugees who have more than earned their place in the Alliance by standing shoulder to shoulder first with my father, and then with me to face that awful peril. The dwarves and the gnomes also stood with us.
If not quite shoulder to shoulder, Ken said.
Anduin had discovered that the softer emotions tended to make the gruff king uncomfortable. Ken wore rage and stubbornness better than warmth or gratitude. So too had Varian for many years. Perhaps not, Anduin said, smiling a little. The joke was one at which the dwarves themselves probably would guffaw. He envisioned their former king, Magni Bronzebeard, retorting with something like,
Nay worries, lad. We'll cut you down to size.
But they have always been there for us, as sturdy and undefeatable as stone. Affection for these strong, hard-headed people, who had been the ones to start him along both his path to the priesthood, as well as toward proper fighting technique, swept through Anduin. We should take this to the Explorers League. They might have some insight that we lack. And they are all over the world. That's a lot of extra eyes and ears for you, Shaw. Shaw nodded his reddish-brown head. Anduin continued. The Night Elves might also be of assistance. As ancient as their race is, perhaps they have encountered something like this before. They too lost many in this war, and I believe a pledge of aid and support would be welcome. And the Draenei, Anduin reached to touch the arm of his old friend Velen. You have lost more than any of us can fully comprehend. And as you say, this material evokes the Naru. Perhaps there is some kind of connection. He returned his attention to the group. All came when we called. And now their veterans have returned to fields too long neglected, to supplies dangerously depleted. We remember what happened after the battle for Northrend. When resources are depleted, sparks of resentment can turn to a conflagration, even among races on the same side. Let us make sure that none of our allies regret having offered aid to Stormwind. They were looking at one another, nodding in agreement. I intend to travel to the lands of our steadfast friends, Anduin informed them, to thank them in person for their sacrifices, to offer what we can so their economic recovery will be swift, and to enlist their aid as well. He had expected Greymane to protest, and the older man did not disappoint.
Your people are in Stormwind, Ken reminded the king unnecessarily. They need you here, and Gilneas at least needs no royal visit.
No, Gilneas did not. It never had. In years past, by the order of Greymane himself, Gilneas had cut itself off from all contact with anything outside its massive stone walls. The kingdom had not come to the aid of others when they were in need, and that isolation had evoked anger and resentment toward the Gilneans, at least at the outset, when they had at last been forced to abandon their self-imposed seclusion. But now there was nothing left of the once great realm but ruins, shades, and sorrow. You were angry with me, as I recall, when I ventured into the Broken Isles to see the place where my father fell, Anduin replied mildly.
Of course I was. You left Stormwind and told no one, Greymane retorted. You hadn't even named a successor. Still haven't, by the way. What would have happened if you'd been killed?
But I wasn't, Anduin countered. And my leaving was the right thing to do. More gently, he continued. Gen, you told me I didn't need to see that place. But I did. To me, my father's sacrifice has made it hallowed ground. It is where I found Charlemagne. Or perhaps, I should say, where it found me. It is where I... He paused. He was not yet ready to tell anyone what he had experienced. Not even Velen, the prophet, would have understood. Where I truly accepted the mantle of my kingship, he said instead. He cleared his throat. His voice was too thick. Where I was able to lead the Alliance to a hard-won victory. Yes, Stormwind's people need me, but so do those in Ironforge and Darnassus. This is how we use peace, to lay the groundwork for unity and prosperity, so that perhaps war might one day be relegated to the history books. It was a noble goal, but perhaps an unattainable one. Most of those around the table seemed to think the latter. But Anduin was determined to try. Ol Emma was what most people in Stormwind knew her as. She was all right with that nickname. She was old, after all, and it was usually spoken with friendliness. But she had a real name, Fellstone, and a past just like everyone else. She had loved and been loved once, and if sometimes she got lost in the past because, well, that was where everyone was, then so be it. First it was her husband, Jem, who had died in the First War. But people died in war, didn't they? And they were honored and remembered in ceremonies like the ones that sweet boy king had led. Anduin Rin reminded her so much of her own bright boys. Three of them there had been. Little Jem, named for his father, Jack, named for his Uncle John, and Jake. They too had died in a war, just like her sister Janice, except that war was worse than the one that had just ended in a way. Her sons had perished because of Arthas Menethil and his war on the living. They'd been warriors of Lordaeron, given places of honor as King Taranis' guards. They'd fallen along with their king and their kingdom. But no one honored their names with a formal ceremony. No one thought of them as war heroes. They'd been turned into mindless, undead monstrosities. They were still in that brutally cruel state, were dead, or had become one of the Banshee Queen's forsaken. Whatever her beautiful son's final fate, they were lost to her, and the living world of humans spoke of such horrors only in whispers. She gripped the handle of the bucket she carried and focused on her task, drawing water from the well. Thinking of Jem, Jack, and Jake was never a good thing, the places it dragged her mind and heart. Emma gripped the handle of her bucket more tightly as she approached the well. "Focus on what the living need," she told herself. "Not the dead. Or the undead." Chapter 5. Stormwind.
"I heard that you spoke most eloquently at the service today, Your Majesty."
Anduin smiled tiredly at the elderly servant. He was quite capable of preparing for bed himself, but Will Benton had taken care of him since he was a little boy, and would be offended if his service was refused.
"Princes and kings have so much to worry about," he had said once,
the first time Anduin had tried to decrease his duties.
"The last thing they need is to bother themselves with things like candlewick trimming and hanging their clothes properly."
He was tall and heavyset, though Anduin noted that he'd slimmed down some recently. His mild, somewhat detached demeanor disguised a stubborn will and fierce devotion to the House of Rin. "So much has changed, and most of it not for the better," Anduin thought. "But at least Will is a constant. If indeed I was eloquent, it was the light speaking through me to comfort those in need of it," Anduin replied.
"You underestimate yourself, Your Majesty. You've always had a way with words."
Will removed Anduin's belt, hanging the mace Fearbreaker reverently from a hook on the wall near the king's bed. The servant himself had mounted the hook there, where Anduin could reach it at any moment. "Just in case," he had said. The prince Anduin had been at the time had rolled his eyes at that. But the man he had become felt his heart warm at the unspoken expression of concern of a man who was more than a servant. Will was an old friend. "You're too kind," Anduin said.
"Oh, sir," Will sighed. "I'm never that, as you well know."
Anduin pressed his lips together to keep from smiling outright. His spirits lifted, and he couldn't resist teasing Will. "You'll be pleased to hear we're going back to Ironforge soon. Unless you'd rather not?"
"Why, Your Majesty, why would I not? There's nothing like the constant heat and clanging of a continuously running giant forge to make certain one rests well. Besides, surely nothing bad ever happens in Ironforge. No one gets turned to diamond or is buried beneath rubble or taken hostage or forced to flee for his life,"
the old servant continued in a voice just shy of sarcastic. Will had accompanied Anduin on his last visit to Ironforge, shortly before the cataclysm had forever altered the face of Azeroth. All the things the servant had just mentioned, along with many others, had occurred on that eventful trip, and two of them had happened to Anduin, the words, meant as a joke, at least as much of a joke as Will could manage, caused another wave of sorrow to flow over the young king. This one, though, was different. The loss was older. Time had mellowed the pain, though it would never completely leave him. At his king's silence, Will looked at him as he hung up the coat.
"Your pardon, Your Majesty,"
he said, his voice heavy with remorse.
"I didn't mean to make light of your loss."
"Of Cosmodan's loss," Anduin said. "The earthquake in Dun Moreau, its tremors felt even in Ironforge, had marked the first indication that the unhappy world was in true peril. Anduin had gone to Dun Moreau to assist with the rescue efforts. He had not yet embraced the path of priesthood, but he knew first aid and desperately wanted to help. The round of aftershocks claimed the life of Aaron Stonehand, the young dwarf woman who had been assigned to train him. It was the first time Anduin had lost anyone close to his age, and if he was being honest with himself, he had begun to feel more than simple friendship toward the bright-eyed, lively warrior. "It's all right," he reassured Will. "Things are better there now. Magni's awoken from his, communing with the earth. I'm just fine. And the three hammers are working together like a well-oiled gnomish machine." Magni Bronzebeard, who had been king of Ironforge at the time, had participated in a ritual that would make him one with the earth. All had hoped the rite would give some insight into the distressed world, but the ritual had been quite literal, not metaphorical. It had turned Magni into diamond. At the time, the already beleaguered city had grieved deeply. Thank the light it transpired that Magni had not been killed, but he had been changed. Now Anduin had been told that the former king spoke with and for Azeroth herself. No one was sure where or how to find him. He wandered the world and came when needed. Anduin wondered if he would ever see Magni again. He hoped so.
"Even so, sir," Will said. "Of course I'll come with you."
Of course he would. As far as Anduin knew, the devoted servant had no family of his own, and he had served the Rinns for most of his life. Anduin didn't need Will's tending. He was quite capable of hanging up a coat by himself and removing his own boots. But his increasing age prohibited Will from doing many things. Anduin knew his childhood servant still wanted to feel that he was of use. Anduin cherished Will, not for what he did, but for who he was. "I'll be glad of your company," Anduin said. And he was. "That will be all for now, though. Good night, Will." The old man bowed.
"Good night, Your Majesty."
Anduin watched him close the door, smiling affectionately after him. When the door snicked shut, he turned back to his dressing table. The amber-hued stone, still wrapped in the handkerchief, sat beside two items that held great personal meaning for Anduin. One was a small carved box that contained Queen Tiffin's engagement and wedding rings. The other was the compass Anduin once had given his father. He looked at the white piece of fabric for a moment, but it was the compass he reached for, the same one that had been recovered and returned to him by an adventurer who had helped the distraught new king on his first steps toward healing his grief. He opened the compass now and regarded the portrait of a little boy painted within, cheeks still round with childhood's softness. After all he had beheld and experienced in the last few months, Anduin wondered if he had ever truly been as young as the artist had depicted him. A compass. Something to keep you on the right path. There had been a clear compass in fighting the Burning Legion. Clear, good, true, and powerful. Anduin knew the immediate next step in his path. To meet with his allies, help them aid their own people, and demonstrate how valuable he considered those ties. To ask for their assistance in learning more about this strange mineral, and keep it from being misused. After that, he closed his eyes. "Light," he prayed, "you have given me good advisors and true who have helped me lead well thus far. I trust in you to show me the next steps in their proper time. I have always longed for peace, and now peace of a sort is upon us. And this material, it could be used to further that peace in ways we can't even begin to imagine. Give me the guidance to lead well now, too." He placed the compass down gently, blew out the single candle Will had left burning on the nightstand, and had no dreams. In the morning, Anduin called for a less formal gathering in the receiving room outside his private quarters. He had spent many a night there, dining alone with his father. He still had difficulty thinking of the room as belonging to him now.
"I had almost forgotten we were heading into summer,"
Greymane said as he helped himself to a sweet-smelling, perfectly ripe peach. Amberseed buns, Stromgarde cheese, herbed eggs, ham, bacon, fresh sunfruit, and pastries also had been laid out, and milk, coffee, tea, and a selection of juices were provided to wash it down. As a worgen, Greymane had hunted for food in a way that the rest of the Alliance could not, and could feed upon things others could not. Worgen were, in many ways, the strongest and best suited to war, for the adage that an army marched on its stomach was a true one. But clearly the King of Gilneas still relished the taste of summer's first fruits. It seemed most of them had slept well, as had the young king. He wondered if it was an effect of the stone. After a few pleasantries about the meal, the king steered the conversation to practicalities. "Gen," he said, helping himself to a second serving of eggs, "I would like to ask you to look after my kingdom while I am away. I can't think of anyone better to tend to it than someone already familiar with what that entails. Don't worry," he added, smiling. "I promise I'll formalize it before I leave this time." Slowly, Gen put down his fork.
"Your Majesty," he said, "I am honored. I will serve Stormwind as I have served two of its kings. But I am an old man. You might do well to begin looking for a way to have someone younger rule should anything happen to you."
Inwardly, Anduin sighed. This was not the first time the subject of an heir had been brought up. He chose to ignore it, but he was almost certain that Gen would reference it at least once more before he left for Ironforge, even though Anduin had made his opinion quite clear. He was not going to marry a woman he didn't love. "I'm pleased you accept," Anduin said, dodging the entire issue and turning to Velen before Gen could pursue it. "Prophet, I hope you will accompany me on my journey both to Ironforge and overseas. I have not forgotten the Draenei who still guard the Exodar. I would see them and thank them." The white-bearded Draenei inclined his head, moved.
"It is an honor to accompany you, Your Majesty. It will mean so much to my people."
"It will mean much to me as well," Anduin replied, buttering his toast. Butter, he thought. Something he took for granted when so many didn't have so much as a slice of bread. What can Stormwind offer the Draenei to show our deep appreciation for their aid against our mutual enemy?
"That Your Majesty cares enough to even inquire after all that you have endured will surely warm their hearts."
The young king placed the butter knife down and regarded his old friend. "You know more of endurance than any of us," he said quietly. "Of suffering. Of loss." Liam Greymane was not the only son who had left behind a loving father. More than even this deeply personal loss was one that Velen's people had suffered. Argus, their beloved homeworld, not only had become overrun with corrupted Eredar, but had been deliberately tortured for eons by the fallen titan Sargeras. The very soul of that broken world had risen to turn on anyone and everyone, even those who had liberated it and sought to help it. Even now, Anduin could hardly bear to think of it, and he prayed to the light that their own world, their beautiful Azeroth, which had sustained such varied and marvelous forms of life, would not suffer the same fate. Velen's face softened with sorrow that would never, could never be assuaged, but his voice was warm as he spoke.
"It is precisely because we know so much of the darkness of this universe that we focus instead on that which is good and kind and true. I say again, your presence in the violet halls of our city will soothe our spirits more than you yet understand."
There was no arguing with a Draenei, Anduin thought. A smile quirked his lips. "It's as you wish, my old friend. But I ask that you set your mind to thinking of something more tangible we can bring as well." The ancient being's own lips curved in a smile that was eternally youthful.
"I will see what I can come up with."
"Good. More pressing is what we need to bring to Ironforge, as it's the first city I intend to visit. What can we offer the dwarves as a gift that they would most appreciate?" For a moment, Brows were furrowed in contemplation. And then, as one, all of them, even the great prophet Velen, began to laugh. Chapter 6. Tenaris. Grizek Fizwrench stepped outside his simple ramshackle hut into the lazy, slowly fading heat of the late afternoon. He smiled at the familiar sound of the ocean lapping against the shore, the rustle of the palm trees. The nostrils on his large, long nose flared, and his narrow chest expanded as he breathed in the salty air.
"Another beautiful day all to myself," he said aloud, cracking his neck, knuckles, and toes in a lovely long stretch.
Then, with a cackle of anticipation, he plunged into the surf. Once he'd been an ordinary goblin. Just like all the others, he'd lived in cramped, less-than-hygienic slums and shanty towns, performing unsavory deeds for even more unsavory people. It had been fine when he was on Kazan, but when that island, well, exploded, which islands were really not supposed to do, and the refugees of the Bilgewater Cartel moved to Ashara, things changed. He didn't like Ashara, for one thing. It was too autumnal for his summer spirit. All those orange and red and brown colors. He liked the blue of sky and sea, and that bright yellow sand, and the soothing waving of green-fronded palm trees. Then, when the shredders began tearing up the land, rendering it ugly, he disliked Ashara even more. The idea of wasting both time and money, which were kind of one and the same, reshaping a part of Ashara to make a symbol of the Horde, seemed like the worst brown-nosing Grizek had ever seen. And he'd seen a lot. And all those other races in the Horde, they just didn't seem to understand the goblin mentality. The debtors, as he thought of the Forsaken, gave him the creeps, and the only thing they seemed to enjoy tinkering with was poisons. The orcs thought they were better than everyone else.
Original Horde,
and all that claptrap. The Tauren were too in love with the land to make any reasonable person comfortable, and the whole thing the trolls had going on with the Loa scared the crap out of him. Pandaren were just too, well, nice. He'd met a blood elf or two he could share a beer with, but the race as a whole was way too pretty, and they liked pretty things, and goblins in their culture most definitely did not qualify as pretty things. But the very worst part of joining the Horde was that the Union had elevated Jaster Gallywix from a simple slimy trade prince to the powerful slimy leader of an entire Horde faction. And then one day, quite suddenly, as if a switch had been flipped, Grizek had had enough. He had taken everything he owned, all of his laboratory knickknacks, books filled with years of painstakingly detailed notes on experiments, and a small warehouse full of supplies, and moved here, to a deserted beach in Tenaris. Working alone in the sweltering sun, which turned his pale yellow-green skin to a rich forest emerald hue, he had constructed a small, modest domicile, and a not-so-small, not-very-modest laboratory. Grizek found that he flourished in solitude and sunlight. He rose in the late afternoon, went for a swim, and broke his fast, then headed into work during the cooler evening and night hours. Over the years, he'd constructed a bristling defense system composed of robots, alarms, whistles, and other warning devices. His favorite such device was Feathers, the unimaginatively named robotic parrot provided what passed for company. Feathers flew reconnaissance several times a day, using its mechanical eyes to scan for anything out of the ordinary. It would immediately alert Grizek to trouble. And then, well, depending on the nature of the intruder, they would be sent off with a gruff warning, or else a blast of the Goblin Dragon Gun Mark II he always kept handy. It was a beautiful life, and he had made many beautiful things. Well, beautiful might not be the right word. He'd made things that blew other things up in a spectacular fashion, and practical gizmos that made it possible for him not to worry about cooking, cleaning, or really anything other than creating more gadgets and explosive devices. And so, of course, when Feathers suddenly appeared while he was lying on his back, floating lazily and squawked loudly,
"Intruder alert! West side entrance!"
it meant that his beautiful life was probably about to implode. Grizek grimaced, listening to Feathers' report. When it came to a single name, though, his eyes snapped open. He swore long, loudly, and colorfully, and swam back to shore.
"Trade, Prince,"
Grizzik said a few moments later, standing at the main gate, dripping and wearing nothing but a towel.
"I thought we had a deal. You got to keep all my inventions. I got to leave the cartel with supplies and peace of mind."
Trade Prince Jaster Galliwix, garishly dressed as always, his round, bulging tummy preceding him by almost 2 full paces, merely smiled. He had brought with him several bruisers, including the muscle-bound Druz, his chief enforcer.
"Hey, Druz,"
Grizzik added.
"Yo, Grizzik," Druz replied.
"Is this how you greet an old friend?" Galliwix boomed.
Grizzik stared at him flatly.
"Traditional goblin etiquette demands that you invite in a trade prince." "Actually, no,"
Grizzik shot back.
"It don't. And anyway, I ain't never been much for etiquette."
Druz leaned against the doorway, cleaning his nails with the knife. The thought of being stabbed with a knife coated with what was under Druz's fingernails was horrifying. Galliwix's smile didn't falter.
12 extremely strong goblins, many of them with guns trained on you, demand that you invite in a trade prince."
Grizzik drooped. He sighed heavily.
"Okay, okay, what's this all about, Galliwix?"
he asked, not bothering with the Horde leader's title.
"What's it always about? Creative expression, intellectual stimulation, and sound sleep at night?"
Grizzik offered.
"Of course not. This is business. Shall we say golden opportunity?"
Galliwix gestured with his cane. Grizzik's eyes automatically went to the orb perched atop it. He'd seen it 1,000 times, that bright red. He blinked.
"It's gold," he said. "Not gold gold, but yes. Ah, so that's the pun."
Galliwix's smile faded somewhat, and Grizzik relished the fact that he was getting underneath the trade prince's skin.
"Yes,"
he said.
"That's the pun. It used to be red."
Galliwix frowned, and his chins jiggled with irritation.
"It did. Same adornment, different color. Come on, Grizzy, you gotta be intrigued by that at least."
Damn the goblin, Grizzik was intrigued. Curiosity, as it always did, got the better of him. Besides, he could stand having his supplies replenished. "I'm gonna regret this," he thought, then opened the gate to admit Galliwix.
"Just you,"
he said as Druz tried to step in.
"I only got one chair."
"It's okay. I'll stand," Druz said.
What passed for the kitchen was cramped, with 3 goblins crammed into it, and there was indeed only one chair. While Galliwix tried to maneuver his bulk into it, Grizzik excused himself to put on a pair of pants and a linen shirt, then stood and listened. Galliwix spoke of delving too deeply into the heart of Kazan, of the single golden glorious vein they had found that had petered out, of how the power of this substance had surged, then seemingly died as time passed, turning from a warm honey hue to red as a drop of human blood. His eyes initially were fixed on the trade prince, but his gaze wandered toward the cane as the story grew ever more fantastic.
"And then,"
Galliwix was saying,
"along comes this giant, titan-whipped-up sword plunged right into Silithus. The earth opened up and there were veins and veins of the stuff, flowing like a beautiful river of pure honey. Of course, I and I alone truly understood what it was, so I jumped right on it. Right now, we've got lots of people mining it and making sure only the right people get it. I'm deeply skeptical that this stuff is the wonder you think it is, Trade Prince."
Grizzik glanced over at Druz for confirmation of the story. Oddly, he and the chief muscle Galliwix employed had always gotten along pretty well. Druz shrugged his massive shoulders. Galliwix's ugly smile deepened, and the small eyes twinkled.
"The proof is in the pudding."
Grizzik blinked.
"What does that even mean?" "No idea, but it sounds good. Look, I'll make a deal with you. Take the cane, touch the top, and see what happens. If you don't want to be involved in working with this stuff, just say the word. I'll be out of your hair. I'm bald. Figure of speech. Okay, but how's about we take it a step further? If you want my help, I get to dictate what I do, what I make, and how it's used.
That did not sit well with the top-hatted trade prince. A smile froze as if Gallywix had run afoul of an angry frost mage.
You're not the only engineer in the world, you know. True enough. But I know you wouldn't have tracked me down after all this time if you didn't need my help.
Grizzik, Gallywix said, sighing. You are too smart for your own good.
Grizzik waited, arms crossed.
All right, the goblin leader said crossly. But you only get paid a small percentage. We'll negotiate my hourly fee and benefits after I decide.
Again, Gallywix stuck out the cane. Grizzik grasped it. He closed his other hand over the top. Everything in the room suddenly came into hyperfocus. The color amplified. The lines were sharp, clean. He heard layers and the sound of the ocean, could almost feel the vibrations of birdsong. And his mind. It raced, tumbled pell-mell, analyzing and calculating what percentage of his hand was in contact with the orb, to what degree a callus or the sheen of sweat on his suddenly damp palm inhibited contact, to what uses this could be put. Grizzik snatched his hand away as if it had been burned. It was glorious, almost too much.
Holy mackerel, he muttered. See?
The engineer's body was still vibrating from the experience, his heart racing, his hands trembling. He knew he had a brilliant mind. He knew he was a genius. It was why Gallywix had sought him out. And the trade prince had been right to do so, because the things that could be created with this stuff.
Okay. I'll work on it. Run experiments, design some prototypes.
Gallywix's smile was cruelly happy now.
I thought you'd come around. My demand still stands, Grizzik insisted. I want full autonomy on this.
He'd betrayed himself earlier with his reaction, he knew, but it wasn't too late to salvage something. He'd been startled, that was all, and now he'd brought his best poker face to bear.
You're dying to get your hands on it, and you know it.
Grizzik shrugged, trying to imitate Drez's utter lack of interest.
Bah, all right, Gallywix huffed. But I'm going to have some of my people out here from now on.
Go right ahead, Grizzik said.
He knew full well that he wouldn't be venturing far from this stuff anyway.
But before we get started, I'm going to write up a list of supplies. And on top of that list, he nodded at the cane tip, is a sample of that.
You'll get plenty of this. Provided that plenty of new things created with it start leaving here on a regular basis. Of course.
Oh, how he hated to say this.
I have one more request. I'm gonna need my former lab partner to work with me on this.
Sure.
Gallywix had gotten what he wanted and clearly was feeling generous.
Give me a name, I'll get him right to you.
Grizzik told him. Gallywix almost exploded, but a quarter of an hour later, he had relented. It was with both relief and reluctance that Grizzik closed the door of his little hut. He wiped off the chair in which Gallywix had sat, just because, and plopped down into it. This was either the best idea of his life or the worst. Grizzik suspected the latter. Chapter 7. Ironforge. Anduin had performed all his kingly obligations, observing the proper protocol upon arriving at the massive gates of Ironforge, and later during the lengthy formal meal. He'd had to pace himself. Dwarves loved to eat, and they loved to drink, and although Anduin was larger than any of them, he was well aware that even the slightest dwarf could drink him under the table if he wasn't careful. Moira Thorason, the daughter of Magni Bronzebeard and the leader of the Dark Iron Dwarf Clan by marriage, was one of the three hammers who governed Ironforge. She personally preferred wine to the beloved beer of most dwarves, and she ensured the visiting king was served one of Ironforge's finest reds, as they dined on braised boar meat with plenty of hearty brown bread to sop the juices, vegetables roasted with honey, and a mountain of pastries with which to end the meal. Anduin had wanted to convene a meeting with the three hammers right away, but they had told him one needed time to digest such a hearty meal. Unless it was a matter of immediate life or death, a pipe, brandy, or more desserts were required first. Moira, observing Anduin's reaction to the option of any of the three, suggested an hour-long amble around Ironforge instead to help them digest. Anduin gratefully accepted. He invited the Draenei to accompany them, but Velen demurred, saying,
"You two have much to discuss, I am certain. I will stay here and converse with Muradin and Falstad."
Muradin Bronzebeard, the middle brother of the three Bronzebeards, represented his family's clan in the Council of Three Hammers. The youngest of the famous brothers, Bran, had founded the Explorers League and had too much wanderlust in him to stay in Ironforge. Falstead Wildhammer, the third hammer and the leader of the famed Wildhammer clan, raised a stein to the Draenei. "Pipe, brandy, or dessert?" Anduin quipped.
"Dessert, I think," Velen replied. "It seems the most innocuous choice."
"Have my share. If I eat another bite, I'll burst."
"Mind if we have a bit of company?"
Moira asked as they rose and left the table. "Of course, anyone you like." The queen spoke quietly with one of the guards, who nodded and stepped out. A few minutes later he returned, escorting a little dwarf boy. The child's skin was an unusual but appealingly warm shade of gray. His eyes were large and green, holding no hint of the red glow common to the Dark Iron Dwarves, and his hair was white. Anduin knew at once who it had to be, Moira's son, Magni Bronzebeard's grandson, and the heir to the throne, Prince Dagrin.
"I know we've met before, Your Majesty, but I'm afraid I don't remember it," the young prince said with perfect politeness and little more than a trace of the local dwarven accent.
How old was he? 6? 7? Anduin recalled that he too had been schooled in etiquette and courtesies appropriate to the child of a king when he was even younger than this lad.
"I'd be astonished if you did. Let us consider this our first meeting."
Anduin leaned forward and extended his hand in a formal manner, and the boy shook it solemnly.
"I'm glad you could join us on our walk today. So, what's your favorite place in Ironforge?"
The boy's eyes lit up.
"The Hollow Explorers!"
Anduin shot Moira a pleased look as he replied,
"Mine too. Let's go."
Once they had reached the hall and enjoyed looking around it, he would ask Moira to summon Falstad, Muradin, and Velen. Then Anduin would reveal the second reason why he had come to Ironforge. As they made their leisurely way toward their destination, human and dwarf guards following at a discreet yet expedient distance, Anduin indulged himself in nostalgia. Heat buffeted him as they passed the great forge that gave the ancient city its name. The distinctive smell of molten metal transported him back to his last visit a few years earlier.
"It's been too long since I've been here," he said to Moira.
Moira's green eyes were on her son as she replied,
"Aye, it has. The years go by faster than we think."
Regarding the boy who was clearly struggling not to race ahead of his mother and the human king, Anduin said to Moira, "It was good of the three hammers to come to Stormwind to honor my father, especially given the fact that the last time I was here, he tried to kill you." Moira chuckled.
"Oh, lad, you know he and I made our peace over that long ago. By the time we lost him, we'd come to admire and respect each other. Your father was angry at me for keeping you here. He was worried for your safety. As Dagran's grown, impossible as it seems, that boy has become more precious to me by the day. Big as Varian Rin was, I'd have torn him apart with my bare hands had he kidnapped my wee one."
A fierce expression flickered across her face. "I believe you," Anduin said, and he did. Dwarves are fighters, that's for sure.
"He was proud of you," Moira said quietly, "even when he didn't understand you. Don't think he only loved you in the later years, Your Majesty."
"I don't. I knew. And please," Anduin said,
Just call me Anduin. I'm more used to friendship than formality here. When I came to visit, your father asked me to call him Uncle Magni, and Aaron called me Little Lion.
Aaron?
A young woman who was the first female in your father's guard. You'd have liked her. She was trying to improve my abilities with sword and shield before she died at Karanos.
Ah,
Moira said, regarding him speculatively.
Lost your first friend, did you?
I'm sorry. She brightened a little.
But at least from what I hear, her teaching wasn't wasted. You're not the warrior your father was, but there's no shame in that, and I understand your swordsmanship isn't half bad these days.
He gave her a wry smile. Surprising everyone, no doubt.
Well, maybe just a wee bit.
Anduin chuckled. I'm definitely not the warrior father was. Never will be. No one will. I can't be the hero you were, he had said, kneeling where his father had died. I can't be the king you were. He turned to her, deciding to confide in her. But I will tell you something. Before I met Aaron, I hated heavy weapons training. I avoided it as much as possible, and I became extremely creative with my excuses. But after she died, I began training in earnest. I didn't shirk it anymore. I wanted to become, if not a superior swordsman, a good one at least. The light has blessed me with other gifts. I trust in it to aid me even when I have no weapon in my hand at all. Aaron promised to dwarf temper me, and she did. Moira laughed out loud at that.
That's as good a term as I've ever heard. Dwarf-tempered, eh? Well, you're a fine specimen, Anduin Rin, and I'm proud my people have contributed to the man you've grown up to be.
Thank you. I'm honored to have such a strong personal friendship with the dwarves. All of them. He hesitated. You all do seem to be getting along.
We're dwarves, she said, shrugging. Words fly. Sometimes so do beer steins. Although I'm thinking that the latter will happen less often when they're full. We're most grateful for your gift.
I could tell. When Anduin had made his formal entrance to Ironforge a few hours earlier, he'd been greeted by the three hammers and an honor guard. They'd made him welcome in this, his first visit as a ruling king, and he knew that welcome was genuine. But when the 10 wagons bearing Stormwind's gift rolled up, and the protective covering was whisked off the first one, thunderous applause and cheers rang out. The gift, of course, was barley, the key ingredient in what was arguably Ironforge's best-loved export. Think of it as Stormwind's contribution to peace and goodwill in Ironforge, Anduin said.
Once you're done with your travels, hurry back, and we'll toast you with the first batch, Moira promised. I've heard the brewmasters are going to call it Anduin's Amber Ale.
That got a full-fledged laugh out of him. She joined in. I can't remember the last time I laughed like that, he said. It feels good.
Aye, it does. To answer your question before we got sidetracked on the extremely important topic of beer, the hammers have been able to work through things, yes.
And how is your father?
Well, she said, he's Diamond now, and Light knows where he is from day to day. Would you like to see where he was?
Yes, I would. Dagrin paused. Up ahead, Anduin could glimpse the shape of the familiar winged skeleton through the archways that marked the Hall of Explorers. The boy looked longingly at it and said,
as long as you promise we come back to the Pterodon.
Magni had become one with the earth in Old Ironforge, a chamber deep below the high seat. The three descended, and Anduin could almost feel the press of tons of stone and earth above him. The dwarves, of course, had no such unease as their path took them deeper still. Anduin knew that the dais where Magni had been turned to diamond would be empty. He knew. Even so, actually seeing it was a shock. He had been present on that day when King Magni Bronzebeard had performed the ancient ritual. Now he stood, wordless, as Dagrin ascended the steps nimbly before his mother and the visiting ruler, bypassing translucent blue-tinted chunks that once had formed the diamond encasement of the Diamond King. The boy went straight for a scroll that had been safely mounted behind glass and began to read aloud. The hairs at the back of Anduin's neck prickled as he heard again the words that had been spoken by Advisor Belgrim, now uttered in the treble tones of Magni's grandchild.
And here are the why and the how, to again become one with the mountain. For behold, we are earthen, or the land, and its soul is ours, its pain is ours, its heartbeat is ours. We sing its song and weep for its beauty, for who would not wish to return home? That is the why, O children of the earth.
Dagrin looked up.
Should I keep going?
No, sweet boy, Moira said. Anduin bent and picked up one of the shards. It was a terrible thing to behold, he said quietly, turning over the diamond chunk in his hands. It happened so quickly, and so completely, I thought he was dead.
And why would you not? Moira said. Even we dwarves thought so.
That had to have been a tremendous shock when he awoke.
That phrase, Moira said, does not begin to capture it. All I can say is it's a good thing dwarven hearts are almost as strong as stone.
Anduin hesitated. I'm so glad. Not just for me and my friendship with him, but for you. There was a time I thought my father and I would never become a real family, but we did. Moira was quiet for a while. Her bright, bookish son was busying himself with another ancient tome, his green eyes flicking over ancient words. When she spoke, she pitched her voice low.
It's for that child that I'd want that more than for myself, she said. It's a lot to undo, Anduin. But he said he wanted to try.
Will you? Anduin asked, speaking quietly so the boy could not hear.
I think my people and my son would be best served by having good relationships with a being who speaks directly to Azeroth.
It was an attempt at lightness, but it fell flat.
But what about you?
Again, Moira was silent. She had just opened her mouth to speak when a voice interrupted her.
Your Highness! Your Majesty! Come quickly!
It was one of the guards usually stationed at the high seat. He was flushed and out of breath.
What is it?
Moira demanded.
It's your father! He's here! And he needs to see you two right away!
Chapter 8 Ironforge. Magni Bronzebeard awaited them in the Hall of Explorers. Anduin, who once had looked on, helpless to intervene as the king was agonizingly transformed into gleaming stone, had thought he would be prepared to meet the awakened Magni. He was not. Magni stood beneath the Pterodon skeleton with his back to the entrance, deep in conversation with Velen and High Explorer Munin Magellus. Falstad and Muradin stood beside them, listening intently, their bushy eyebrows drawn together in concern. High Tinker Gelban Mechatork, the white-bearded leader of the gnomes, whose cheerful demeanor belied his deep, quiet wisdom, also had been summoned. Anduin had scheduled a meeting with him for the next day. The gnomes had been invaluable against the Legion, and he wanted to make sure he had a chance to thank the physically smallest, but perhaps intellectually greatest members of the Alliance. The presence of the High Tinker's advisor, the gruff warrior Captain Tred Sparknozzle, whose black eye patch was testimony to his years of battlefield experience, indicated that this was no mere diplomatic visit on Magni's part. When the glittering shape turned to Anduin, the young king felt as if he had been punched in the gut. A thing made of stone should not move so gracefully, nor should its diamond beard flutter with that movement. Magni was neither the dwarf he had been, nor the statue he had become. He was both, and neither, and the juxtaposition struck Anduin on a profound level. A heartbeat later, though, gratitude and joy flooded him at Magni's words.
Anduin! My, you've grown!
The phrase loathed by children everywhere was transformed by the power of nostalgia and the inexorable arrival of adulthood. It was so ordinary a phrase, so real, that the illusion of other was as shattered as Magni's diamond prison had been. The voice was warm, living, and very definitely Magni's. Anduin wondered whether the diamond flesh would be warm too, if he were to touch the being who now strode toward him. But the spurs and shards that dotted the dwarf-shaped form precluded the enthusiastic handshakes and crushing hugs that Magni had been so prone to in his former incarnation. Had Moira or Dagrin found a way around that? Did Magni even wish to bestow the gestures he'd been so free with during his life as a being of flesh and blood? For the sake of all of them, Anduin hoped so. Moira had asked Belgrim to take care of Dagrin, who had protested that he wanted to meet his grandfather. "We'll see," she said. Her face wasn't hard exactly, but it was concerned. "Magni," Anduin said, "it's so good to see you."
"And ye and me daughter."
Magni turned his stone eyes to Moira.
"I dare to hope that once me duty's done here, I might be able to meet me grandson. But sadly a visit's ne'er what I've come about."
"Of course not." Magni spoke for Azeroth now, and that was a great and solemn duty. Anduin's gaze flickered to the Draenei. Velen was not a maudlin soul. He smiled easily and warmly, and often laughed. But he had known so much pain that it was those lines his ancient face remembered, cutting through his visage as if they had been chiseled, and they were set in a grim expression now. Magni regarded Moira, Anduin, and Velen seriously.
"I've sought the three of you out, nay because all of you are leaders of your people, but because you are priests."
Moira and Anduin exchanged surprised glances. Anduin was aware of this commonality, of course, but for some reason he hadn't given much thought to it.
"She's in terrible pain,"
he said, his diamond face, seemingly so hard, furrowing easily into an empathetic wince. Anduin wondered if the rite that had so transformed Magni meant that he could now literally sense Azeroth's pain. Anduin thought of the destruction of Silithus, of the almost inconceivable size of the sword now towering over the landscape. If Sargeras' last attempt to destroy Azeroth had come close to succeeding, it was a terrifying thought.
"She needs healing, and that's what priests do. She made it clear that all must heal her, or all will perish."
Velen and Moira turned to each other.
"I believe that the words your father has spoken are true," the Draenei said. "If we do not tend to our wounded world, as many of us as possible, then most assuredly, we all will perish. There are others who must hear this message."
"Aye," Moira said. "And I think it's time that the lad met the rest of us."
And as one, the two turned to look directly at Anduin. Anduin's brow furrowed in confusion. "The rest of whom?"
"Other priests," Moira said. "The Prophet and I have been working with a group you're long overdue to get to know."
And then Anduin understood. The Conclave. In the Netherlight Temple. The very name seemed to set calm upon Anduin's soul, almost in defiance of the temple's history as the prison for Saraka, a void lord and a fallen Naru, and its location in the heart of the Twisting Nether. For eons, the Draenei had studied the creature. Only recently had they been able to purify it. Now, as its true self, Sa'ara, the Naru, lingered, embracing its former prison as a sanctuary it offered to others. Anduin had heard about the struggle that had unfolded in the early days of the Legion's invasion, and he knew that many who now walked its hallowed halls were, like the Naru itself, those who had fallen into darkness, but had been brought back into the light. These priests, known as the Conclave, had reached out to others on Azeroth so they would join together to help stand against the onslaught of the Legion. Although the threat had ended, the Conclave still existed, offering help and compassion to all who would seek the light. "What the Conclave did and continues to do is so important," Anduin said. During the war they had roamed Azeroth, recruiting priests to tend to those who were on the front lines against the Legion. Now they still tended to those courageous fighters as they dealt with lasting injuries to body, mind, and spirit. Not all scars were physical. "I wish I could have assisted their efforts during the war."
"Dear boy," Velen said, "you have always been right where you needed to be. We have our own paths, our own struggles. My son's fate was mine. Moira's path is overcoming prejudice and championing the Dark Irons who believe in her. Yours was succeeding a great king and governing the people who have